Imagine a world in which post-traumatic stress no longer robs from millions who suffer.
You don't want to get help because you're embarrassed. You don't want to tell people the dark stuff that you've went through.
That stigmatism of you can't talk to people is so true.
Post-traumatic stress is not a disorder. It's an injury that can be healed quickly so that those who suffer get back to thriving in their families, communities, and mission.
And I said, I don't want to live this trauma again. Yeah. And he goes, You don't have to. Yeah. And I said, What?
The experts, they forgot to tell me I can heal. I didn't know that I can get rid of PTSD.
Each week, we tell a skeptical world what is possible with stories of those who have successfully cured their trauma.
I just remember being able to stand by the water and look up at the sky and hear the noises, and I didn't think they were gunshots. I was like, those are Disney fireworks.
I don't even know what to imagine for myself now, my future, because I have one.
This is Life After PTSD. I want to welcome everybody to another episode of Life After PTSD. My name is Jeff McLaughlin, your host here in Orlando, Florida, and Carrie Russell, my cohort on the show. How are you doing today?
Doing great. We've been doing podcasts all day.
We have, but I'm really excited for this one. I mean, I'm excited for all the ones that we do, but this is an interesting day for sure. On the line with us today is Craig Scott. He was the brother of Rachel Joy Scott, who was killed in 1999. April 20th, Columbine shootings. I was a senior in high school. We're going to talk about that story and how a school in South Florida could be impacted by what happened in Littleton, Colorado. But before we get in there, Craig Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jeff and Carrie, so much for having me.
Hey, it is an absolute honor to talk to you. Literally, I get this email the other day from Craig. He was talking about some things. I was on an email list, and I said, I don't know how I got on the list, man, but I'm so glad you wrote. Like, can we talk? You know, you just don't have those opportunities, you know, every single day. Craig, I'm going to just give some audience context here and then have you take over and tell the story from the perspective as someone who was there, and then we'll get into our discussion. April 20th, 1999, I'm not in a great place in my life. Certainly wasn't, you know, a student kid. I was a senior in high school with vision or whatever, just kind of getting by, doing my thing. And we get the news of this shooting that happened in Littleton, Colorado. And we were, you know, back in the days of tube TVs that you would wheel into the classrooms. You love those days when you would walk into a classroom and there was a TV there because you knew, all right, sweet, movie day, right? You're not having to do any real work in the class or whatever. And I specifically remember being, I think, in a shop class of all things, took shop. And so there was a TV in the room there, and we flipped it on, got the news, saw what was going on, and it was just, whoa, what just happened here? What just happened? And of course, such a gripping story that probably the rest of the day, you know, at home, you're seeing things come across on the news. I mean, it was, I'm sure, utter chaos, you know, there, but it felt like utter chaos here. And then the subsequent days for us, what was impactful for the school was there was a movement of kids who came dressed I don't know if it was the next day, but following days, in trench coats, almost in a stand of solidarity and support for what had happened on behalf of the shooters. And I just remember, you know, at the time being deeply offended by that. I didn't know why. In fairness, I'm sure those were traumatized kids. They were hurting kids in retrospect, but processing that as a senior in high school, it was just, something changed there, because for me, that was the first school shooting that I remembered happening, you know, ever. And there were others, I know, but that was the first one that I felt like, you know, I'd ever seen before. And so prior to that, in our own school, we would have bomb drills and bomb threats and things like that. Nobody took these seriously. Like, in fact, I would say the common assumption my school was, all right, who didn't write their term paper, right? Went to the payphone, mind you, right? Find one of those these days, called in an anonymous threat, and they had to act on every single one of them. And so what did that mean for the rest of us? We're out in the hot summer, you know, hot South Florida heat out there for an hour or so before somebody finally deems the thing uncredible or whatever it was. All right, go back inside and that kind of thing. So it was just a major inconvenience, but we probably had seven or eight of those during my high school career. But about a year later, I read an account or one family's account of that day at a time in my life where I was in a much different place, and really starting to realize that my life was without vision, and I really wasn't living into my gifts, my skill set, and really wasn't making any kind of impact whatsoever in the world. And so I began to fall in love with some of the stories of those who were killed. Obviously not the part that they were killed, but who they were becoming as young men and young women leading up to that tragic day. So I'll stop there and just say that it's an honor to speak to you, Craig, because Rachel, there were some others certainly in that, you know, in that group that were killed that I got to know their stories thereafter as books were written, stories were told, and they had a deep impact on my life, one that I never forgot. And so fast forward many, many, many years when the shootings happened in Parkland, okay, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, Valentine's Day 2018, Parkland is the sister city to Coral Springs. Coral Springs is where I grew up. My high school was our chief rivals were Douglas High School. And that was a city, when that shooting happened, first reaction was, oh my goodness, I would have never thought in a million years something like that would have ever happened here. Probably similar words being said 20 years earlier in Littleton, Colorado. So Craig, I want to just give you a chance to kind of share with the audience. You were Rachel's brother, but you're also Craig, and that has an identity in and of itself, and you've done some wonderful things over the years. Wonderful speaker. Just tell the audience a little bit about you, and if you would, maybe a little bit about that story and what your experience was on that fateful day.
Well, it was a day that impacted our country, and so many people were tuning in, and if you're old enough to remember and you're listening, where you were and what you were doing that day. And it was the first big mass school shooting that happened in our country. And it was, you know, on everybody's mind was why. And there was a narrative that was really painted by the national media that went kind of something like that two kids were bullied at school to the point of getting revenge. And that's why you had those guys at your school or people at your school coming in wearing the trench coats, because they maybe had been bullied, or they had friends that were bullied, and they were taking a stand. Unfortunately, that wasn't the real story. A lot of times the national media gets things wrong, and we quickly jump onto their narrative thinking it's the truth. And it really usually takes time for the full story to come out on any situation. And if you were to ask me why the shooting happened today, I would tell you that the biggest reason I believe the shooting happened, and this is after obviously living in that community, going to that school, getting to know their families a little bit, reading their journals, getting to know their friends and stories about them. I would say the biggest reason the shooters did the shooting was because they focused on everything that was negative in their life, and they focused on everything that was negative in this world. And that's what led them to do the shooting. It wasn't other people. It was their own view, and that brought them to that place. But I'll share what I experienced that day. I was on my way to school with my sister, Rachel, and her and I got into a little argument because every morning I was taking too long to get ready for school. I had to have my hair absolutely perfect, and she was getting on to me about making us late. And we got into a little argument, and I started calling her names. And I got out of the car. She was a kind person. She would actually go drop me off at the front and then go park, even though I was making us late. And I remember getting out of the car, looking at her and slamming the car door shut, and never dreaming that that would be the last time that I would spend with her. I went into the school and my classes, and then during my lunch period, I went to the library, and I was studying for a test when I heard some popping noises coming from outside the school. It was April 20th, and so I thought maybe some seniors were pulling a senior prank and brought some firecrackers to school. We're setting them off. So people around the room were kind of like, you know, looking around like, what's that noise? But with kind of like a smile on our faces, like, what kind of mischief is going on? And a few minutes went by and a teacher ran into the room. She was very frantic and she ran over to the phone and she started yelling at all of us to hide and to get underneath tables. And she said that there were two students outside the school with guns shooting other students. But she was so terrified that honestly I didn't really understand what she was saying at first. And I thought, is she in on this prank? And she got on the phone and called the police. And you hear, there's a recording of that audio she had with the police. You can hear her being very frantic. And she's saying, under the table, kids, kids get under the table. And she's talking to the operator with the police and saying, you know, get over to the school. So you hear her yelling at us kids to hide underneath tables and desks. And so I understood that part and got underneath a table with two of my friends, Matt and Isaiah. And not knowing what was going on and hearing these popping noises getting louder and louder, and wondering, you know, what's going on. And I felt a quiet voice within me tell me to be still. And I didn't know what that was about, but I felt a whisper in my spirit. It was, be still. And so I became very quiet. And my two friends, you know, they're very like, what's going on? What's going on? And I just became very quiet. And then as the popping noises got louder and louder and the shooters came into the school, they were throwing these pipe bombs that were causing little explosions and trembling in the ground. So it started to sound more serious. And that's when we started to get scared, and all of us. But I was staying quiet. My two friends were basically freaking out, you know, what's going on? And so these popping noises are getting louder and louder. And I'm starting to realize that these are gunshots. And the library was the first room that the two shooters came into. And immediately they were shooting off their guns and they were going around the room and they were yelling things at all of us. And then they would also, like target students, or they would come across a student and mock them before they shot or killed them. And they were saying things like, you know, you're all going to pay and it's our time now. At one point, one of them said, get anybody with a white hat on, because a lot of jocks at my school, and I was one of them, wore white baseball caps with like sports teams logos on them. And so they had a hit list. They had been bullied to some degree at our school. But I knew kids that were bullied a lot worse than them. And they actually were probably bigger bullies than most kids themselves. I mean, I know stories of how they treated other people. So, they themselves were not these kind, nice people. So they went around the room and they would peek underneath a table and say peekaboo and shoot a girl. And they came over to where I was sitting and they saw my friend Isaiah. Isaiah was one of the very few black students at my school. And one of them called the other one over and said, hey, we have an N-word over here. And the other shooter came over and they started to make racial slurs at Isaiah. And then they started to drag him out from underneath the table. At this point I had, I was being very still. I had laid down on my side and I was just pretending to be dead. Didn't want to draw any attention to myself. And, they were making fun of Isaiah. And, the last thing that Isaiah said was, I want to see my mom. And they didn't know Isaiah, but he, was a senior who, was going to be the first person from his family to graduate from high school. And he had a calendar on his fridge, and every day that he would get another day down on his last year, he would put a red X through it. A lot of times he would say to his mom, another day down, mom. And so the last thing that he said was, I want to see my mom. And they shot and killed Isaiah, and then they shot and killed Matt. and walked away from my area. My ears are ringing so loud from the shotgun blast, and I thought I was going to die. And at one point, one of them was standing behind me and said, I wonder what it would be like to use a knife on someone. And I thought they were talking about me. And so I thought they were going to just knife me in the back. And so I'm just completely overtaken with fear and paralyzed with it. I can't move. My heart is beating so hard that I thought at one point I was going to have a heart attack. It was just too much for me to handle. And so at another point I had heard before they came over to my area, I had heard a conversation they had with a girl. And what happened was they had walked by this girl and she said, "Oh God." And it caught one of their attention. And one of them said, "God, you believe in God?" And they had this conversation back and forth where she was begging for her life. And they kept asking if she believed in God. And it was going back and forth, back and forth. And then finally she said, "Yes." And then you heard some gunshots and you didn't hear her crying anymore. And so there I was underneath this table, just paralyzed with fear. My two friends were taking their last breaths, and I was covered in their blood, lying in their blood, and thinking I was going to die. And a little bit of time went by and the two shooters left the library. I didn't know that they had left. My ears are ringing very loud from the shotgun blast. I thought my ears are bleeding. But that's when I heard a voice, that same voice, tell me, "Get out of there." And you can call it God, you can call it spirit. Some people would say it's your conscience or intuition. And I think it was my God. I think it was God speaking to me. But it said, "Get out of there." But I couldn't move. I was paralyzed with this fear. So I prayed and I said, "Take away this fear." And immediately after I prayed that, it happened. I was able to, this fear was relieved in a huge way. I was able to think and move. And I was the first student in the library to stand up. I looked around the room. I saw that the shooters were gone. And I yelled at everyone, "Come on, let's get out of here. I think they're gone." And no one moved at first. Everyone was too scared. And so again, I kind of had to rally. And I was, "Let's get out, everyone. Let's go. Let's get out of here. I think they're gone." And I heard someone asking for help. And I turned around behind me. There was a girl who had had her shoulder blown off from a shotgun blast. And she was rocking back and forth and she was asking for help over and over. And so I helped to pick her up and a group of us, about 20, 25 of us ran out of an emergency exit. And I was carrying this girl and there was a police car outside a little bit of distance away in a field. And we all ran and it was like running for our lives to get behind this police car. And as soon as we got behind that police car, the two shooters came back into the library. And I realized as soon as that happened, they started exchanging gunfire with the police. I realized that we got out of there just in time. And I realized that that voice saved my life and probably saved, you know, a lot of those kids' lives. So behind the police car, we were just taking cover. And, there was a girl that had ran out with us. There was some kids that had actually been shot that made it out with us that were injured. And there was one girl that was lying down and she was losing a lot of blood. And I don't know how I ended up doing this, but I guess I just went over and I held her and she was wanting to go to sleep. She was saying, "I'm sleepy." And the only thing I knew was you're not supposed to go to sleep. Like if you're losing blood, I think maybe a movie or something. So I'm holding her and I'm trying to keep her awake and I'm telling her it's going to be okay. You're going to be okay. It's going to be okay. And other police cars began to come by and pick up students. And we loaded up the injured first. And then an ambulance came and I, and a few others were the last ones to leave behind the police car. I actually told the police, I gave him a description of the shooters. I said, it's two tall guys with with black trench coats on. And so, right before I left, the last car to pick us students, a police car, right before I left, I had a buddy, Byron, who tapped me on the shoulder. And he said, "I think there's a girl that's been shot over there." And he was pointing out back towards the library door. And I remember looking out from behind the police car and the tire and seeing this body of a girl. I didn't recognize who it was. And then getting in the police car, and the police car took us to a nearby street. And we didn't have really cell phones back then. And so there was we were in a neighborhood, and neighbors were coming out of their houses, and there was just a portable telephone that was being passed around to people to be able to use. And so I called my mom, and the first words out of my mouth were, "Mom, I'm okay, but I think there's, I think there's something wrong with Rachel." And I had no idea why I said that, but I just had a feeling. And then I started to pray with other students, and actually the news camera caught it, a glimpse of it, of me leading like a group of students in prayer. And I just wanted to pray for people that were still in the school, because even though I had just witnessed the worst thing ever in my life, I was so happy to be alive. When I ran out, I mean, the relief you feel, because it's so heavy. It's the heaviest feeling when you think that you're going to die, and you're not ready for it. And to then know you have your life it's an amazing feeling. So it's a weird bittersweet. It's a weird high and low at the same time. And so I just was praying for people that were still in there. And on that street, more people began to come, more ambulances, and you see news footage of it, of them loading up injured students in ambulances. And there's people, families being reunited, parents that are coming that are hugging their daughter or son, and friends that are seeing each other, and people that are crying, and just a little bit chaotic. Was on the street for a while, and I was watching people being reunited with other people and hoping to see Rachel. And then finally I went home, and I remember a stranger gave me a ride. It was a friend's older brother. And I remember, it was weird, but I got into the car, and he was playing this like really negative, heavy, like rap music. And I love rap, but I got in the car, and it was, I almost like wanted to shield myself from it, hearing it. This is weird, but for the next couple years after the shooting, the best way I can describe it to you is I was very sensitive to life and death. And I was very sensitive to dark and light, not physical darkness and lightness, but spiritual lightness and darkness. I was very sensitive to it. And I didn't want to hear it. And I was so glad when he dropped me off just to get out of the car. And I walked into my home, and I had blood all over my clothes. And there were my other two sisters and my little brother. And I had cousins that went to Columbine. And one of my cousins, Jeff, he said, "Whose blood is that?" And I said, "It's Isaiah's." And he knew Isaiah. He was a senior, and he just started bawling and crying. And I was in total shock. I didn't have like any emotion. And the first thing is so strange that I started to do is I started to clean the house, because I thought, I had this weird feeling that Rachel wasn't coming home, and I wanted the house to be nice for my mom. And so I remember there were these wooden blocks, and I was putting them back, these toy things, and cleaning. And then we waited all day and waited through the night. And the next morning, I got a phone call from the police department, and they said that Rachel was the first one that was killed. And my mom came down to tell me the news, and I already knew. And when she came, I remember she came downstairs, and I was at the bottom of the stairs, and she's shorter than me. And when she got to the bottom, she was eyes filled with tears. And she said, "Craig, Rachel didn't make it. She was killed. She was the first one killed." And I put my hands on her shoulder and I said, "Mom, I'm going to be okay. God's going to take care of me." And I'm so glad I said that to her, because I knew that she was, not only was she dealing with losing a daughter, now she had to deal with a son that had been through hell and wondering what's going on with me. And I just wanted to relieve her of that. And I'm sure I didn't completely, and definitely didn't over the coming years, but at least for that time and space and that moment, I did some. And, you know, I really felt in the next, especially the next few days and week, I really felt people praying for me. And that sounds weird and mystical. I would have never said that before, and I don't say it often. I haven't felt it often, but I felt being helped, like a grace came over me. Maybe it was partly the shock, but I really felt a grace came over me. And 2 days after the shooting, I got a call from the Today Show, and they asked me if I would come on with Katie Couric. And I'd never watched the news. I didn't care. I didn't know who Katie Couric was, but they said they were going to have Isaiah's dad on the show. And so I wanted to go on because I wanted to give Isaiah's dad a hug. I spent the last moments with his son. And so I went on the show. Katie Couric is now a good friend of mine, and she has said it's her most powerful interview that she's ever done. And I've been on the Today Show about 10 times since after that. But my dad watched, and he said he just felt an anointing come over the interview. And I know, again, that sounds, you know, uber spiritual, but he said that something special. And what was crazy was the day the shooting happened, if you watched any of the footage, it was a beautiful spring day in Colorado. And then the very next day, it just poured down snow. And so here I am in this interview, and I've got highlighted blonde hair, and I'm sitting next to this big black man, and then Katie Couric, and it's just pouring down snow like the skies are crying. And one of the most powerful moments of the interview was when Katie, she first of all wouldn't let the network go to commercial. So uninterrupted in an interview that went on for a while. And I told about the last moments of Isaiah's life, and his dad started crying. And then he reached out and grabbed my hand as I was telling the story. And then I put my hand over his, and it was just a really cool moment on TV. This white, you know, blonde white teenager holding hands with this big black father, you know, as Katie is asking us questions, and they zoom in onto those hands. But you know, that was a day that was the first time I would talk about it, and I didn't know that I would talk about it thousands of more times. But I remember even the very first time, again, that grace being over me, and has been over me every time that I have felt like I've shared her story, my sister's story. And I made an effort the first time, even on that interview, that I was going to tell my sister's story. And it would be over the next year or two that we would learn a lot more about some things she left behind, kind, compassionate things that she did for other people, and these amazing journals that she left behind that gave a prophetic sense about her own life being short, that she felt like she wasn't going to live old enough to get married, but that God was going to use her to impact millions of people. And you fast forward all this time later, and now her story is the biggest story told in person in public schools in the world today. There's probably around 50 speakers worldwide that travel and share her story in schools and talk about this kind, compassionate person who went out of her way for people that were sitting on the outside to start a chain reaction of kindness and compassion, which was we got from an essay that she wrote a month before she was killed. And her story has been made into a movie, and over 40, 50 books about her story or parts of her story. She's been very inspiring to people of faith. And so she really has impacted, her story has impacted millions. And so, you know, I, like many people or some people that go through a tragedy, you know, it became a mission of mine to make a difference from what happened.
I love the story because I've heard about the starting a chain reaction. You know, I'd love for you to share that piece. But the one thing, you know, as you were talking, and I just was thinking, you know, the points that hit me is, you know, your sister was so kind to you, and you didn't always catch that, right? And you didn't have, you know, you didn't, you didn't catch it.
Yeah.
You didn't, you know, you looking back, it's like, oh wow, she drove me up. You know, all those small acts of kindness that, you know, were just who she was.
Yeah.
And so I think we, you know, and I just appreciate that you're sharing her story, because also you're also given a really big task as a young kid, right? So all of a sudden, you know, you were leading people out of a school, and then they catch you praying with people. And so all of a sudden you're kind of thrust into this light of like this kid that is, you know, gonna carry us to the next, whatever that is, right? Like it's a hope. It represents hope, you know? And that had to be a really hard thing too. You know, like, okay, now I'm the one here. And also, how old were your other siblings?
Well, my other siblings were, I have a other sister that's 8 years older and another one that's 4 years older. And then a little brother that's 1 year older. But, you know, I think that I was, I had all this grace, all these people praying for me. And it, to me, that's what carried me through. I wasn't this strong person. I was being given strength, and also, you know, not just spiritually speaking, but, you know, if you don't want to think of it, if you don't believe in any of that, but I also just had people that were very kind to me after, journalists. I mean, almost every experience I've had, and I've literally had thousands of experiences with news media, has been kind, compassionate, sympathetic. And, even the first time that I got a talk on the news, I was able to share whatever I wanted uninterrupted. And so that I had a positive experience immediately talking about it. And that was helpful to have. And so I am an advocate of, talking about it in a healthy way. And what I mean by that is, I was able to talk about it in a way, especially initially. I think initially it doesn't matter how you talk about it. You just need to get it out. You just need to talk about it. But after a while, you need to gauge if you're reliving and reopening the past, and if it's actually doing more damage than good, because you can get, which we all do so often, get trapped in our past. We get trapped in our past hurts and tragedies. And when we actually talk about it, we just strengthen that neural pathway. And we also can reopen the wound. And it's like having a cut that wants to heal, and we keep picking at it, so it reopens, and then it has to reheal. And people, there are people that do that for years and decades. And so, for me, that's not why I share at this point. In fact, it's probably more anti-healing for me at this point to talk about it, but that's not why I do it. I don't need to do it for healing. I do it because I hope that it helps people, and I hope that they can hear the message behind it that can help them in their journey, in their story. But yeah, you're right. It was, you would look at a 16-year-old kid and be like, how is he gonna, and Oprah, I've been on Oprah's show 4 times. She said this to me the first time I met her. She said, I don't know how you made it. She said, I watched you do the interview with Katie Couric. And she said, I literally didn't think you were going to make it as a person. I just thought you were, with what you experienced, you just were going to be a shell, and you weren't just going to make it in life. And she said, how did you make it? And my answer was, well, there were a lot of things that helped me, but the number one thing that helped me was the grace of God. And that was my honest answer.
Hey, Life After PTSD listeners. We're glad that you love other stories of healing, but what about you? First Orlando Counseling is the premier trauma therapy center in Central Florida with a full staff of trained clinicians ready to help you clear your trauma without re-traumatization. Childhood abuse, relationship abuse, a traumatic car accident, birth trauma, first responder or military trauma, even phobias. You don't have to live like this. It's time for you to heal. Schedule a consultation today by visiting firstorlandocounseling.com or call 407-514-4470. It's that easy.
Here we are back with Life After PTSD, having an incredible conversation with Craig Scott. This is an honor. I can't say that enough. It's pretty evident in just how this is impacting me thus far. Guys, let's jump back in.
I love the way you started when you were talking about the shooters, and you said, you know, hey, the story came out that they were bullied, and I can remember that because I had, in 1999, I had 2 little boys, and you know, they were 2 and 6 at the time, and I can remember specifically my 6-year-old making this huge deal about how we treat people, and it was because of that, right? And we need to treat people anyway. We think about that. But I love what you said. It's not that they were bullied. It's they chose to focus on everything that was wrong around them. And
yeah,
even right now in our society or community, and not, you know, we have to choose what we focus on, right? What we feed grows. And, you know, I love that it sounds like what you've chosen to do is feed the positive in this horrible, tragic story. I mean, it's horrible. There's no way around losing your sister. That's not tragic, but it's,
yeah, and
there's been so much good.
Yeah. And you're absolutely right. One of my biggest messages when I talk to teens is what you place your attention on, you give power to. Whatever you focus on and you have a choice, you just grow in your brain, in yourself, and it can make other, it can grow it for other people to think about it and place their attention on it. And if you place, if you're always placing your attention on the negative, even if it's trying to fight the negative, don't try to fight the negative. Start doing good, and it will automatically negate the negative. When we go into school, when I go into schools, I don't try to talk to kids about stop bullying and stop doing wrong things. I talk to them about, inspire them with Rachel's story to be compassionate and kind, and be your best self. And in doing that, it will automatically get rid of that bullying. I really learned a lot about the issue of bullying, and there's a two-sided coin. On the one side, you have where we should be kind and compassionate to people. And of course, that's doesn't always happen. And so we do, we should be that way towards, on the other side of it is don't expect that in life. Don't have an expectation that that's how you're going to be treated, because if you do, you'll be disappointed. And so I've realized that, you know, we are responsible for our thoughts, our emotions, obviously our words and our actions. But a lot of people, especially kids, they don't really believe or understand that they're responsible for their thoughts. No one else is. So someone comes and treats me in a negative way. Say, Craig, you're a loser. Craig, you're fat. Craig, you're stupid. Craig, you're whatever, right? Well, it's actually my thoughts that are going to affect my feeling. I can hear those words, and I can think, oh, I am stupid. I am fat. I am these things. And then I feel negative about myself. Or I can think, wow, this person is never been shown how to really be kind. Or maybe they have a bad family life, or maybe they're insecure, or maybe this person is just trying to get a laugh out of people around them. See, it's how I see. So in between what happens to me and what is done to me and what is said to me, and see my response to it is B, what I think about it, what I think about what is being said or done to me. Because I can know my own value, know my own worth, which every person has incredible inherent value. It's the name of my program, Value Up. Everyone has incredible value. And if they believe that about themselves, somebody comes to you with those words and it doesn't affect you at all. It won't, you can see right through it. You can see through that this doesn't have to deal with me and my worth. This has to deal with this person's problems. So with bullying, you know, I am a promoter on my sister's behalf of kindness and compassion. At the same time, I'm a promoter of you are responsible for your feelings and thoughts. When you really get down to it, no one can make you feel anything except you, if you really take control of your thoughts and your brain and take responsibility for it.
Yeah, and it's so interesting. He's a neuroscientist, Andrew Huberman. He talks about thoughts being such an interesting thing because we can choose to have one, right? I can choose to think about how that person's treating me and, you know, this is them. They're hurting people, hurt people, right? And then often, sometimes thoughts just fly in your head, right? Like you're not looking for it. And at that moment, people think, oh, well, I don't have control over it. Okay, so it came to you. Suddenly, this thought came. You can then what you choose to do with it. It's what you just said, right? What you choose to do with that thought. So, an old wound or an old thought, an old story that you told yourself could just come at you out of nowhere, or you feel like
and feelings with that too.
True,
and
true. So
that's where we say, you made me angry. You made me upset. And that can be true in the sense that we can have a knee jerk or just a reactionary emotion that we weren't planning for that just happened. We didn't try to have all of a sudden be angry. But exactly what you're saying, it's then we have to be an observer of our thoughts. We have to learn. That's one of the things my father taught me. His name is Daryl Scott. He's written a lot of books and he's very well respected in the educational community. But he told me, Craig, you have to be an observer of your thoughts. And you have to decide when you recognize a thought, you have to decide, is that me? Is that me? Do I want that in my life? And so you can actually feel that in somebody comes up. I had a girl come up to me after a presentation who I found out later was bullied a lot in her life through her school. She was wearing a trench coat. This is about 6-7 years after the shooting. I just poured my heart out sharing to students, and usually I get a lot of amazing, wonderful, positive responses back of lives being changed. But she came up, first one came up to me. I came down off the stage. First words out of her mouth were, they should have killed more of you. And I had an immediate action of just anger. How dare you? And I just shared my sister's story. And you're saying they should have killed more of you. And my initial reaction, of course, I mean, most people, anger. How Absolutely. Dare you? But I chose to be a see-through-er and see through her words. And see, there was a hurting girl here I was dealing with, and then recognize And then I said, don't react to myself. Don't react. And so I just stood there. I didn't say anything. And she walked off. And then a bunch of other kids came up and said very good stuff. And then out of a place where I was calm, my RPMs had lowered. I was able to then go over to the principal. And I asked the principal, said, hey, that girl that came up to me, I didn't tell him what she said. Said, that girl that came up to me wearing the trench coat, could you get her out of class for an hour? I'd like to talk with her. And he did. He said, absolutely. And they got her out of class, just her and I, nobody else. And we sat in a room, a science room, for an hour. And first, all I did was just listen to her. And I realized I was dealing with a girl who associated with the shooters because she had been bullied so much and she was hurting so much and she identified with them. And so she thought what they did was right, that how dare they be treated this way. And, you know, good for them for sticking up for themselves and getting revenge. And by the end of our conversation, she realized how wrong what those two guys were doing, that those guys were the biggest bullies that day themselves. She went from idolizing the two shooters to idolizing Rachel in a good way, and realizing that what these two guys had done was very wrong. But what if I had just reacted? Or what if I had dealt just with her words or her action? What if I had gone over to the principal? How dare you? You wait right there. Let me get your principal. Mr. Johnson, come over here. Tell him what you just told me. Tell him. Do you think that would have had any impact on her? Would she have changed one iota?
Possibly negatively. I mean, it would have made it worse.
Yeah, probably negatively. No, yeah. But I didn't react. I was a see-through-er and saw through the action. Didn't deal with the action. Didn't deal with the words, but looking in her heart. And because I did that, and because I operated out of spirit and not soul, I was able, not out of emotions or my will or my intellect, but on a deeper place, I was able to have a spiritual impact on her. And she had a change of heart that day.
Yeah. I love that, because you had a thought that came at you, right? You were angry. How dare you? You know, whatever that first thought was, is a normal thought. But then, like you said, you were an observer. You kind of stepped back. Okay, let me observe what I'm doing. And then you chose, okay, I'm going to see through. There's more to this. And I think, you know, there's more to what's going on. So that's amazing. It's an amazing story.
Craig, if I could ask a question, the grieving process. I've always said we live in a world that we don't know how to grieve, certainly not grieve well. You know, many times we go through these tragic situations or even loss that's expected, if that's what somebody's going through, and they don't get the chance to ever process it because everybody else kind of expects that it's time to move on. I often have thought that some of the motivation behind that is just we don't know what to say and we're not comfortable living in that place of sort of awkwardness, uncertainty or whatever, or just disruption in our lives. What was your journey of grief after? And what would you say to somebody who is grieving a tragic event in their life that they've experienced?
Well, I think you're exactly right. I think that we have to sit in it with somebody that's dealing with it. And I really appreciated it at times when I was really grieving. And we deal with all kinds of grief in our life. And when somebody will just sit there with us in it and just be with us, that I think is the most you can do. And sometimes you want to say something, and sometimes the best thing is not to say anything. In fact, the best times that I remember people really that I connected with helping me was when they just came and sat with me in it. Mm. Didn't try to get me out of it. Didn't try to, you know, at some point it is appropriate to try to get somebody out of that if they're stuck in it.
Of course.
But to try to annihilate or nullify that necessary process is not good for a person. They need to be able, a person needs to be able to grieve, because if you don't, you're suppressing, or you're also in denial, and that will come to haunt you later. So just sit with somebody in it. And yeah, I've carried around a lot of sadness in my life. In fact, actually coming into this new year, 2021, I actually had to let go of sadness. I went to, I was in Atlanta a few weeks ago, and I got invited to go to this prayer group, and I went, and this lady didn't know me. She was sitting in the corner, real humble lady. She came up to me at one point. We were praying for people, and I'm not always a part of these kinds of groups, but I was this day. I got invited, so I went, and she came up to me and she said, "I don't know what this means, I feel to tell you this." And she put her hand on my shoulder and she said, "Why so sad, son?" And I just started bawling. And out of nowhere, I said, I wasn't thinking about it, but I said, "I carry a sadness of a generation."
Wow. And you do. I mean, that was the beginning.
Well, I've heard so many people's sad stories. And I mean, if you get to know me, I'm actually a pretty fun guy. And I don't like to be heavy and depressing, but I've heard so much tragedy in my life from people.
Yeah. I had to let it go.
I had to not carry it around with me. And you can see I'm still, it's a process to let go. But after I left this meeting, another lady, she came to me and she said, "I feel like you deal with self-pity." And I was like, "Self-pity? I'm not a self-pity person. I hate self-pity." She said, "Well, shelve it, but I feel like you," she was part of this prayer group. She said, "I felt like that was something I should tell you." And I thought about it later on. And in my own meditation, I thought, I am dealing with some self-pity and I need to let that go. But you know what? This relates to so many of us that go through tragedy. We also can't be victims of pitying ourselves. We have to really realize that that there's someone out there that's been through worse. There always is. I've met so many of them. People that meet me, they're like, feel that way about me. They're like, "Look at what this guy's been through, and he's doing something good with him in life." Well, I've met so many more people who have been through so much worse that haven't seen anything good come from it. And so we really have to recognize when we're just living in a pity party. So it's a balance of dealing with grief. There's a point in time where you're living in self-pity and feeling sorry for yourself. And there's a time where you absolutely need to embrace that grief, embrace that sadness, embrace. And if you're seeing somebody that's dealing with it, embrace it with them. Don't try to get it to go away. And then sometimes if this is something that's happened to you 5-10 years ago and you're still living it in it today, it's possibly because you're dealing with unforgiveness. It's possible that you are probably a prisoner at that point in your own mind, and a prisoner of your past, and you have to take some steps to not be in that place anymore. So there is a time to, you know, come around as a friend and be like, "Hey man, cheer up, you know, hey bucko, there's some good stuff in this world. Why don't you smile once in a while?"
Well, also get some therapy, right? Get some therapy, get some help. you know,
absolutely.
You shared earlier, but when we were offline, that yeah, you had some therapy, you did get some help. It was short term and it was, but it sounds like to me a lot of your healing came from helping others, which gives you compassion fatigue, right? I mean, I know as a therapist, hearing people's stories, but I'm a therapist, that's my job, right? But I get compassion fatigue because I'm hearing these stories and I'm like, oh, this is so, I mean, in fact, I walked in here right before we got on the air and I was telling, And I was telling him about a story I heard on the way here. And I was like, oh, it's so sad. And so I think, you know, self-pity, mitigating between self-pity and also just compassion fatigue, feeling that for all these people, the stories that you heard.
Yeah. And one really important life skill I had to pick up along was not to carry out of the room other people's stuff. I could be in it with somebody. I could sit in their sadness with them, or in their grief, or even their anger, or whatever emotion they're dealing with. But I don't walk, when I leave that school, when I leave that auditorium, or wherever I'm speaking or conference, I don't walk away with all of that. In fact, I don't, unless I have to do something about it, I don't think about it. I mean, I will now move on. I will on to the next thing. I'll get in the car and I'll play some of my favorite music. I'll look at the trees. I'll call a friend. Hey man, how's your day? Good. How's your day? I don't then go into, oh man, unless I need to process, I don't then go into all this heaviness I just experienced. You know, oh, it was good. It was tough, but it was really good. But you know, here, guess what I'm doing tomorrow? You know, I'm going to go skiing, you know, whatever. So yeah, you don't want to carry other people's stuff around with you. That's an unnecessary burden. If you're dealing honestly with life, you already have enough to deal with during the day. Don't go adding on. And some people, you know, mistakenly just confuse that with compassion. They're like, well, that's just a compassionate person that does that. They feel for other people. But it's not good for you. It's uncompassion for yourself. You have to be compassionate towards yourself too.
Absolutely.
When you carry it around unnecessarily, you have to know when you sit in it with somebody and when you dust it off, you know, brush off your shoulder and be like, okay, that's over. That's done. I'm not going to carry this with me. We could sit around and hear people's sad stories all day or watch the news and let it tank us emotionally. And people do that, unfortunately. I barely watch the news.
Yeah. I had a text last night. You need to watch the news today because of what happened. And I was like, just give me the highlights. I don't watch it. Same.
I don't even want the highlights most of the time. No. I don't want to give my attention to things that are outside of my control. Mm. I want to deal with my sphere of influence and my responsibilities. I've got enough to deal with there. And so, you know, I'm not saying.
No, that's really
don't
powerful.
Know what ever is going on in the world, but if you are just constantly giving attention to the media, which really they make money on sensationalism, and they make money more, they get more viewership on negative stories. Our brain is, I believe it's 8 times more likely to remember a negative experience than a positive experience. Mm-hmm. It's 8 times more likely to make an impression. So the news, they intuitively know this and they make money that way. And so that's why most of the news is negative. Mm-hmm. If it were positive, which I wish it was, I wish there was more positive, they wouldn't make as much money. Mm-hmm. And that's the core at what the news does. Yeah. It's their business.
Yeah.
So, you know, what you place your attention on, you give power to. It comes back to that.
Yeah, I was going to say the three, I mean, there's so many takeaways from this talk, but the three things that I am thinking of right now that I want to go home and share is what you just said. Yeah, what you focus on, what you pay attention to, you give power to. Mm-hmm. And that's so, and be an observer of your thoughts. You know, let's be an observer, step back, look at where that's. Mm-hmm. And the two-sided coin you talked about, you know what? We need to be kind and compassionate, but we don't expect that of others, you know? Mm. And actually, I said three, but a fourth thing is to be a see-through-er, right? Whatever's happening.
That was powerful. Craig.
Yeah, to
that
be a see-through-er. So we want to...
Craig, how do we... We want to let the audience know how they can best connect with you and your message. I know that COVID, you know, normally would be doing a lot of speaking, and because of everything that's gone on, that's been diminished. And everything, but you're doing some things online. How to start there and tell them what you're up to. And you're also, you got some other things in business that, that they, we always love to support our guests because there's some people that, you know, you've spent an hour of in their heads, in their earphones in the last hour or so, you know, feeding them, feeding their spirit, their soul. So please allow us to do that for you.
Well, first of all, if there's anybody that's listening and they want to contact me personally for any reason, they can at my email is craig@value-up.org. Again, that's craig@value-up.org.
And we'll put that in notes too.
And my, I have a program for schools and speaking. If you know of a school, or a youth group or a youth audience, or, and it doesn't just have to be youth. I speak at educational conferences. I've spoken to companies. I've spoken at a lot of venues, churches. And if you have any interest in having me come, I usually have a filled speaking schedule, but due to COVID, I do not. And that's my calling and that's my passion. So I really want to get back out there as much as I can. So if you can help me do that, I would love to help people in your area. So if you need more information, go to valueup.org. That's the name of my organization. It's called Value Up. And there, if you need references or information, there's a lot of stuff just online about me. There's a lot of news interviews. Just type in my name, Craig Scott Columbine. A lot comes up. You can see glimpses of me speaking and what I have to share. Mm. But I share some of these things in my presentation. My presentation that I have is more of a story, and in it are the lessons. But I make the points, and I try not to be so heavy. And so I heard a quote.
I have to interrupt. Let me just interrupt you really fast. Not only does he's not heavy, it's so riveting. My children attended the First Academy in Orlando, and they had him there. And it's, you end up singing a song at the end of his, okay? So my kids came home and told me the whole story, told me all kinds of, just, we had this incredible conversation. And I changed my schedule because I really had something else to do that night, but he was going to be there that night speaking to parents. And so I was like, okay. And my kids were like, you want to talk to him and you want to hear him. And so I went back and we ended up singing Lean On Me, you know, at the end, and everyone, people, and I was kind of in a little bit of annoyed mood when I went, just because I had a lot to do. And I was like, oh, I know what he's going to say. I've heard him before. I read the stuff. I've seen him on news, you know, but he was really riveting. And it really, my kids, and in fact, I told you earlier, I told my kids I was talking to you today. They're like, oh, that's pretty cool, you know? So, it's sad that you had this notoriety because of a tragedy, but it's so amazing what you're doing. And so I want you to have lots of speaking engagements and, it creates lots of conversation.
Well, I've spoken all over the country in inner city and rural. I was in Chicago once at an all black school. And every time I go to an all-black school, the principal is a little worried, are you going to be able to connect with the audience? And I love to dance. And when I start dancing, I do this white boy dancing in my presentation. And when I start dancing at black schools, oh my gosh, the kids love me. They want to, and I get them to come up and we have a little dance off and the mascot comes out. And then a lot of times I get them to point out their favorite teacher and I do a flip on her. So I have, and I remember, so I was at this school and the principal was and he's like, hey, listen, I'm right here on the front row. If these kids, and it was a tough school, but I had them. He's sitting on the front and said, if they give you any trouble, I'm going to be right here. And I just kind of smiled to myself and I whispered in his ears, kids were all coming in and being really raucous, noisy. And I said, in about half an hour, I'm going to have your entire student body with their standing up with their arms around each other, singing Lean On Me. And he leaned back, looked me in the face and dead eyed. He goes, good luck. And half an hour, his entire student body with their arms around each other, every last one of them, seeing him lean on me.
I believe it.
Yeah. One last thing, concerning, sadness, grief, heaviness. I heard actually a quote just last night. Jeff invited me to be on, or two nights ago, to be on a part of a town hall meeting in Coral Springs that the mayor hosted. And there was about 30 mental health professionals. And there was one doctor who I really liked what he had to say, but he said, look at your life like a joyous adventure. He said, see your life that way. And I wrote it down. I put it on my wall because that's my favorite new quote is looking at your life like an adventure. And so even when you're dealing with hard things, if you look at it like an adventure, the way you see things is so important. Mm-hmm. So, but yes, if anyone's out there and they think that I might be a good fit for some venue, please don't hesitate to contact me, craig@value-up.org.
And if you need a mortgage.
If you need a mortgage, Craig, right? You do that too. Tell them about that real quick, would you?
Yeah. So, because I lost all my events, I had to do something. And I have a friend who's been successful with doing home loans. And he said, why don't you do home loans with me? So this last year, I became a home loan originator, home loan broker. So if you're out there and you need a home loan, I'm with a company called Cardinal Financial. They're a great company. They're very competitive, usually won't be beat on a rate or closing cost. So if you're out there and you're listening and you need a home loan, also part of my commission from it goes towards my program, developing more mental health curriculum. I have some really great curriculum I've really honed and worked on for over a decade that I give to schools when I go. And so it helps to develop that. So speaking or home loans or dancing, or if you need a hug and to sing Lean On Me, craig@value-up.org.
It's a man of many, many talents. What's that look like on a LinkedIn page, man? How do you project that right? Craig, yeah. I want to thank you so much. I am, from the bottom of my heart, it is an honor. You telling the story of all of the things that I heard about from a distance that affected my life many years ago and still have has just been a treat and an honor. I got choked up for a second earlier, and that's the first time that's ever happened. And how many episodes on this show?
And
where I was like, Carrie, you're going to
take over. I know, I'm saw that, and I was like,
And I'm so grateful for that. So thank you for a sacred moment together that we got to share. And I know that there are listeners out there who needed to hear this episode and also know someone that needs to hear this episode. And so, guys, we don't make shameless plugs here. We make it for other people. You want to sing Lean On Me? Call this guy, right? No. But we don't do that for the show. The only thing we've ever asked is to share. And the reason is because this story is too powerful to not be heard by those out there that need to hear it. So may we never hoard the message, the good blessing that we got. Give it away to somebody. Find us on all major platforms and subscribe. Get notifications so that you're aware of when episodes like this with great guests like Craig come out. And we will catch you next week on Life After PTSD. To learn more about our work, visit lifeafterptsd.org and find further reading and resources to help you on your journey and opportunities to partner with this mission. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe and give us a 5-star review and share it with your community. For production inquiries or to sponsor the show, email info@lifeafterptsd.org.